Yeah, I'll be talking with Gilad Osman in just a second. I do want to clarify something. Some of the terms we use, he has a book that if you haven't read, it's a little bit of inside baseball. And so to clarify something before anybody freaks out, when he says Jewish power, think of that not as Jews in general. What would you think of if someone said white power? You think of white racists. When they're saying Jewish power, it doesn't mean the Jews magically all together or conspiring on something. We're talking about racist Jews or the concept of chosenness. And there are degrees of racism. Not everybody is a full-on fledged colonizer ready to kill, you know, Palestinians. Some people have a slighter degree of racism, but they still have this otherness and betterness, which you see a lot of in the progressive left, this sort of paternalism and milder forms of prejudice. And that's what we're talking about. It extends everything from ethnic nepotism all the way to the hardline Zionist psychopath that would like to murder everyone that's not in his tribe. So with that little caveat out of the way, let's begin the podcast.
All right, Mr. Gilad Osman, author of The Wandering Who, probably the best book, if not the only book, that tries to tackle the very taboo subject of Jewish identity politics. I appreciate your courage in writing such a book.
Thank you so much, man. It's very kind of you saying it. I am indeed the target of a lot of Judeo-driven smear campaigns, but I don't like to see myself as a victim. It was very clear to me that for saying what should be said, I may encounter a serious opposition, and I was totally correct. And I can tell my detractors that The Wandering Who is just the beginning. I will soon publish a book that actually will bring much more light into those issues, and I'll expose the very troubling connection between liberal Zionism, liberal Zionist funding system, the Soros Open Society Network, and so on, and the left and the Progressive Network, and Palestinian BDS, and Palestinian NGOs, and I'll show how corruptive it is. And those who follow my writing pretty much know where I'm going, but this is my job. I'm basically a whistleblower, and I clearly went against my people because I think that there were a few wrong things there, you know, whether it is Zionism or even Jewish anti-Zionism. But I've now found a lot of troubling facts also within the Palestinian discourse. And I'm not going to be quiet about it. I'm really excited about truth. Not that I know what the truth is, but I'm very excited and angry when I find people spinning in broad daylight.
We've got several layers here. You had the very basic layer, which I think everyone understands. We have like groups like the ADL and stuff. We just call everybody anti-Semitic who oppose the apartheid state of Israel. But those kind of lunatics aren't as damaging, maybe perhaps, as some of these so-called anti-Zionist groups who they may oppose apartheid and they oppose, you know, racial colonization and the very obvious criminal things that the state of Israel is doing. But they'd like to narrow the debate down and say it has nothing to do with religion, it has nothing to do with Jewish identity, it's all about neocolonialism and this and that. And of course, there is a bit of, you know, military profiteering and secular reasoning there, but to reject religion as a whole, as not being part of it at all, and chastising everybody who says otherwise, and calling them anti-Semitic, makes some of the anti-Zionists just as bad as the more crazy wings of open Zionists.
In fact, I actually argue that the so-called anti-Zionists are actually far more dangerous, and this is crucial. You see, I like to talk about Jewish power. There is no doubt that the Jewish power plays a major role in contemporary politics, banking, and so on and so on. The Jewish lobby openly pushes for a war in Syria before that conflict with Iran and so on and so on. There is no doubt about it. However, I argue that all those events that can easily detect, you can read my book, you can read John Mearsheimer, Stephen Walt, about the Israeli lobby, you can read James Petras, you can read Jeff Blankfort, and so on and so on. I argue that what they describe is not Jewish power, it is actually just symptoms of Jewish power. The real meaning of Jewish power is the capacity to stop us from talking about Jewish power. So Jewish power is not the embodiment of the pro-Zionist, for instance, activity, the exposure of the pro-Zionist activity or pro-war activity. Jewish power is the successful tendency to stop us from looking into it. Now, this is not done by Dershowitz or Foxman, ADL Foxman. This is done by the Jewish left and the left in general. The role of the left and the Jewish left in particular is to stop us from looking into Jewish power. In other words, the definition of Jewish power is the capacity to stop us from looking into Jewish power. And this is exactly what Noam Chomsky did on Democracy Now when he had to discuss John Mearsheimer. Mm-hmm. He dismissed this whole approach, instead of discussing it. Finkelstein, Norman Finkelstein, did pretty much the same thing. By the way, Democracy Now should have brought Stephen Walt, John Mearsheimer, to debate Chomsky, but they didn't. They operated as an instrument of Jewish power, diverting the attention from the issues. Now, it is not a secret that the vast majority of progressive organizations in America, the vast majorities of Palestinian NGOs, the vast majority of Palestinian solidarity groups are supported by George Soros Open Society, that also support the Zionist liberal J Street. And this is why we see a suspicious similarity between the ideals presented by liberal Zionism and the progressive network. And this is what transformed the left, which stands for beautiful values that I understand and respect to a certain extent. This is what transformed the left into a dubious network of control opposition.
Yeah, they'll preach against occupation and they'll preach against the racism and all these things, but they won't allow you to discuss the root of what caused all those things at all.
By the way, I have to react to something that you said before. You spoke about apartheid. The left really want us to talk about Israel as an apartheid system. They have a reason. To start with, Israel exhibits and perform many symptoms of apartheid. There is a racist operation in place. There is abuse that is racially driven. However, apartheid is a system of exploitation. Apartheid in America, in the south of the United States, was a system of exploitation. The same applies to South Africa. But Israel doesn't want to exploit the Palestinians. They want them gone. They want them to leave. They want them to be cleansed. They want to wake up in the morning, tomorrow morning, and to see that the Palestinians are gone.
It's more akin to the genocide of the Indians.
Which means that Israel is not an apartheid. It is actually an expansionist, nationalist, and racially driven ethnic cleanser, which is much similar to it's much closer to Nazi Germany. Mm-hmm. Now, the left is very disturbed with this equation, and this is why they push the apartheid discourse. The leftists denounced me because I said that Israel is not apartheid. In fact, I said that it's far worse than apartheid. It is Nazi-like. And this is an issue that they don't want to deal with. Now, why they don't want to deal with? Because they believe that they have the intellectual tools to deal with apartheid. Because if you have apartheid, it's part of a colonial system, and then you have post-colonial, and then there is a image of reconciliation. But they are completely wrong. Israel is not a colonial state, because, I mean, Zionism is not a colonial phenomenon, because colonialism is a clear setting of exchange, material exchange between mother state and settler state. Israel is indeed the settler state, but there is no mother state for the Zionist project. Alamu is a very interesting thinker, saw it somehow. He said, yes, it's a very unique form of colonialism. Instead of a mother state, he said, instead of a mother state, what we have is a surrogate mom. So yes, initially it was the English, and then the British, and then it was the French, and then it was the American, and maybe next decade it will be India or China. But this is not really the way colonialism operated. Now, why they don't want us to deal, why they don't like me saying that it's not colonialism? Because it means that we are dealing with a very unique project that, and we cannot draw any parallel, a significant parallel with other historical chapters, and the Marxists don't know how to deal with it.
Mm. It's hard. It's such a confusing issue for people because the basic terminology has all been hijacked. For example, a settlement is a very nice sounding word for a Jewish only city that was land confiscated by force. And that is more akin to Nazism, or I guess the colonialism of centuries ago, Manifest Destiny style colonialism, you could say.
By the way, the only interesting aspect when we talk about colonialism, the relationship between the Israeli state and the settler movement is a colonial relationship. Because you clearly see what is the mother state, the state of Israel, and the settlers are the colonialist soldiers. Mm-hmm. So actually, within the Israeli politics, we can see an element of colonialism. But our progressive don't like even to get into this, to look into this internal model. They prefer to see Zionism as colonialism, and they're totally wrong there. Now, the question is, the most interesting question, is why an intellectual so-called member of the left cannot deal with an intellectual criticism. Why is it that when they are criticized, they prefer to murder you rather, or to destroy you or whatever, rather than engage in a debate? This is a very good question. I think that that Orwell looked into it. He had a chance to encounter Stalinism. He was himself a Trotskyite at a certain stage. And he understood what those members of people of who believe in dictatorship of proletarian are going to bring along. And this is 1984. He saw it already in 1948. Shocking. But this is where we are now.
You can see that same phenomena with some of the progressive, pro-war progressives who may poo on the neocons, but then find some other humanitarian reasons or what have you to invade Libya or support terrorists in Syria. And it's a controlled opposition completely. But with Israel, I think it's a little bit more confusing for people.
Totally, totally correct. And this is something that I mention all the time. The word progressive is in itself a Jewish expression. It's the secular form of chosenness. When you call yourself progressive, it means that you see yourself in far more positive light than the other, i.e. the reactionary. This is exactly the meaning of chosenness. Progressiveness suggests we are good, others aren't.
It's the old paternal form of racism.
Yeah. And this is why so many secular Jews along the history of the 19th and the 20th century were so attracted to progressive ideology. It allowed them to be chosen without wearing a yarmulke. Simple, isn't it? Simple and devastating. And this is why Stalin, willing executioners who killed millions of people in the gulags, were largely Jewish Bolsheviks. And Yuri Slezkin writes about it. Israeli writers and historians write about it. We explore it. This is why the Holodomor was the murder of millions of Ukrainians through famine was perpetrated by the same Jewish radical Bolsheviks who, in the name of progressive idea of collectivization, destroyed millions of Russians. And we are not even dealing with it. You know, everybody in America or in England or in France know about the Holocaust. How many people know about the Holodomor?
Very, very few.
There is this beautiful film called Defamation. Mm-hmm. And there is a beautiful scene there where Abe Foxman is meeting either with the Ukrainian president or Belarus president. I don't remember. It's out of my mind. I'm going to meet the director in 2 days here in London. He presents his new film. And Abe Foxman tells this president, he tells him, listen, we can help you in America. We can sort you out. But make sure that you don't talk about the Holocaust, or you don't mention the Holodomor. There is a reason why we don't know about this systematic annihilation of entire population. And I want to talk about it. Gramsci understood it. He understood that they may not even have a proletar movement marching to the capital, let alone a global one. The only people who yet failed to integrate into the national ideology and were not exactly working class per se, but were cosmopolitan, were the Jews. And this is why they operated in Spain as a cosmopolitan brigade. Interestingly enough, the left bought into this peculiar agenda through identity politics. Mm-hmm. So, for instance, those who identify as lesbians or as black or as Muslim actually succumb to a cosmopolitan worldview that is pushed by the Jewish, by the Jewish progressive ideology. And this is why we see an international campaign against Russia, an international gay campaign against Russia. I'm not getting into the question whether it is right or wrong. I'm not going to defend Putin or criticize. It's different, completely different issue. I'm interested in the structure, in the ideological structure that mobilizes this international cosmopolitan view. And it can backfire because what you may find out that instead of promoting your interest on international level, you may find yourself hated by the international community. And this is exactly what happened to, it's devastating to say, to Jews in the 1930s in Europe. Hitler's call found to be very, very popular amongst many nationalists in Europe. It's not a secret that it was actually the Free French who delivered their Jews to the Nazis. Mm-hmm. It's not a secret. And the same happened in Hungary and in Romania and so on and so on. And I try to tell gays, be careful when you operate politically internationally. There is a lesson to learn here.
Any kind of vicious in-group will bring about a backlash toward themselves, because though you may be right in defending your own rights as a whatever your group is, if you are exclusive like that and you can't be inclusive, whether it's race or your sexuality or whatever, you are pushing out everyone that isn't you. And it doesn't work historically.
You used the exact right word. All those biologically determinist categories that are implemented within the political discourse are exclusive by nature.
Mm-hmm. And defined by what they aren't.
Sorry?
They're also defined by what they are not, also.
Exactly.
I'm gay because I'm not heterosexual, and I'm Jewish because I'm not Jewish, you know.
Exactly. And this is, I think, one of the most, you really quote one of the most important issues that I elaborate on in The Wandering Goo. I speak about negative dialectic being defined by otherness, so on and so on. And indeed, these philosophies are exclusive. They incline to develop some elements of chosenness. They are very dangerous.
And so instead of being a person that believes X or a person who likes the same sex or something, you are the Muslim, the lesbian, the whatever first. And yeah, it's exclusionary.
I tell you why the left likes it so much. And this is something that I only realized recently, and this is going to be in the center of my new book. You see, in America, you have 300 million people. In the world our parents grew up in, and maybe us as youngsters, I'm much older than you, so I don't know if it applies to you. We believe that we are many, many people with many, many desires. We believed that somehow if we would make the effort, we may be able to fulfill our desires. And this was slightly problematic because, you see, 300 million people allows theoretically 300 million desires. It's very hard to control and it's very hard to sustain. And then we invented identity politics. Instead of thinking as Ryan or Gilad or John or Ed or Susie or Julie, we start to talk as a gay, as a Jew, as a progressive, as a Muslim, as a black, as a Christian Zionist, as a. Now, when you speak as a, you don't speak as yourself. You speak as a, rather than identifying with yourself, with your authenticity, you identify with an external vague concept. So you lose your authenticity, really, for real, you lose your authenticity. It's crucial.
And in that, you're also passing around the chips on the shoulder, because what you can do is, as a whatever, you are the collective victim of whatever's happened to the group you chose all through history. Could be 500 years ago what the Catholics did to so-and-so, or, you know, 1,000 years ago what happened to so-and-so. And so you have the Jewish victimhood status of the Holocaust, or the Ukrainian victims of World War II, or the American Indians victim of their colonialism, or black victims of slavery, or Irish victims of this and that.
Sure.
And what it causes in Muslim, Christian, and religions, you can add all that stuff too, is this kind of carried on hatred for centuries, or for some, to want revenge, or to want some extra kind of respect something.
For sure.
And sort of demonizing whatever group the other group that did it to them is guilty of something they didn't do that happened a long time ago, because they identify with this particular group, even though they may, let's say, been born in Chicago and been an American and live right next door to the person they're harping on their whole life, had the exact same school, lifestyle, everything, but they identify genetically or religiously or sexually or something with some victim group. And walk around with those goggles of just disdain for everyone else because of what happened to them that didn't happen to them. It happened to the group they identified with.
This is true. However, the biggest manipulative exercise that involved with this form of identity politics, the as a, it reduces 300 million Americans into something like 25 synagogues. Instead of dealing with a lot of desires and a lot of wishes, we are reducing entire society into a very small amount of Reform Judaic congregations that identify as gay, as a Muslim, as a Jew. And then it is very easy to control. Because, for instance, for the left, instead of dealing with production and making sure that the working class wake up in the morning and they have a place to go to work with, to work in, sorry, that they have a car factory in Detroit. I've been in Detroit 3 months ago. It's a ghost town. Instead of that, all we have is sectarian wars between the Muslims and the gays and the Jews and that's it. And this is why America, rather than dealing with crucial issues to do with production and labor and being a meaningful place, we are dealing all over the world with idiotic questions to do with gay marriages. And obviously I'm not against gay marriages, but this is not the real most concerning issue in contemporary world affair.
You have, I call it a demographic circus, where they're just playing to this particular group or that particular group and avoiding the major issues, you know, spending $16 trillion on Wall Street, on pointless wars, on, you know, foreign aid to despots, etc. That doesn't get touched. Instead, this distraction is gay marriage or some wedge issue like this, or are this group going to get their pension funds or not, and not looking at the core system for our banking and foreign policy and sort of systematic underlying problems in society. are chopped up, and people talk endlessly about sex and race and religion, which are not really important issues. They're a problem of their own creation.
Yeah.
Ralph Nader talked a lot about that. Is if you want to get a rise out of college students, you go after an ism. You accuse somebody of being racist or sexist, regards to women or gays or whatever, or a bigot, and they'll explode. But you kill a million Iraqis or 2 million Vietnamese or whatever, and it's just the normal course.
Exactly. And you know exactly this is why I really don't believe the left and it is and its modus operandi. Not because I have a problem with the ideology. I believe that the left, the idea, was hijacked. And indeed, the second Iraq war is a very devastating example. A week before the war started, we had a massive demonstration here. Some estimates suggest that we had 4 million people in the street. This is a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
They all shouted against the war. This didn't stop Tony Blair and his criminal government from taking us into a war. Interestingly enough, a few months later, when it became clear that Iraq didn't have WMD, when it became clear that hundreds of thousands of Iraqis lost their life, when it became clear that Fallujah is contaminated with uranium, the anti-war movement didn't manage to bring anyone to the street. Which means that all this idea of pickets and demonstrations is a form of mass and colossal form of masturbation. Now, masturbation is a good thing, apparently. I really know about it, even. But it's not something that you do in public.
It is something. I call it feel-good activism versus do-good activism. This feel-good activism is, there are a lot of people, I've been to protests, I was at the RNC protest and the Iraq War protest up in New York City, I went all the way from Virginia, and there were tons and tons of people there who just are protesting for the sake of it, and they had every issue in the world, not even just against the Iraq War, they're just there complaining about whatever they want to complain about, because it's a interesting, kind of fun thing to do, to be there. And to protest, but how many of them were very sincere, or even knew much about the causes of the war? Who lied? This cabal of Israeli partisans really that sold us the war in Iraq for the United States. That's another question. But they disappeared, and when Obama took office, there were even fewer, even though it's the same policies. And so it wasn't that they really opposed the war so much as they opposed Bush and Blair. They didn't like. In the United States, they didn't like Republicans. That was the other tribe, so to speak. And so that's what they hated, not the war. As soon as it was the same war under a different banner, they supported it. So they were never really anti-war. They just didn't like the other tribe being in charge of the war.
Now, you are totally right. And I, you know that I'm very open about it. I refuse to be called an activist. I'm very active, but I'm not an activist. I believe that instead of going to the street and protesting in front of a bank or a Israeli shop or whatever, there is a fundamental and shouting slogans together with many other people without really understanding what they mean, where they come from, and what they serve, I believe that the real danger that we can inflict on imperialism, on power, and so on, is to start to say what we think. For instance, and I'm a major contribution into this transformation. Start to say what you think about Jewish power. As soon as you do that, you see that people start to move. They start to protest. They start to think. They flip. But it brings a change. I see how I myself published a small book of, I don't know, what is it, 120 pages? And what a mess. And what a mess. And this book will stay forever.
I have it right here, actually. It's, well, without the epilogue, maybe 177 pages, but...
All right, sorry, still, I don't remember.
Thin book. It depends on the size you have, yeah.
It's a kind of a pocket book. I believe in pocket book. You know, manifestos. And this is the real issue. Once we start to scratch the truth, a lot of beautiful things happening. The enemies they show their face. Was it a big surprise that I was attacked simultaneously by Foxman of the ADL, Dershowitz, who is another ADL, and Ali Abu Nima and Max Blumenthal? Is it a surprise? No. Because they come from the same place.
Now, Blumenthal accused you of being, that was the only name he could recall off the top of his head, too, and he actually said you were anti-Semitic. What? Is that all he had to say? I mean, why is he going after you? For what?
Because
this is a person who's supposedly, you know, against occupation and wants peace and some kind of resolution, he says. So why is he at odds with you?
It is very simple. Because Max Blumenthal wants to identify Zionism as the enemy, which means that he and another dozen of Jews in New York are innocent. Now, I definitely don't think that Max Blumenthal is innocent. I think, as Jeff Blankfort, whom I love a lot, suggested 2-3 weeks ago, he said, Jewish left are not the solution, they are a continuation of the problem. But I, in my work, actually don't blame the Jews. I'm surrounded with Jews who have nothing to do with the Israeli crime, they have nothing to do with Jewish power, they have nothing to do with pushing Britain into a war or America into a war in Iraq. So I don't talk about Jews, but I don't think the Jewish identity politics is innocent. And this is how I created my categories, and it is no doubt, I argue in my book, and it's very, very simple, that Jews who identify as Jews are divided into three categories. Jews who believe in the Torah, which is an innocent category. Jews who happen to be Jewish because of their heritage, you know, they have Jewish ancestors and so on, innocent category. And then Jews who are identifying primarily as Jews, politically, for instance. The Zionists are identifying primarily as Jews. But what is very interesting is that the Jewish left also, like the Zionists, identify primarily as Jews. Now,
they're both Azas.
Huh?
They're both Azas.
Aza, exactly.
Aza Zionist or Aza Jewish anti-Zionist.
Aza Jewish anti-Zionist, exactly.
Right.
And basically what I suggest, that both Zionist and Jewish anti-Zionist belong to the third category. Now, I took it from Chaim Weizmann. It's funny enough, it's very hard to identify exactly where Chaim Weizmann said it, but it's definitely attributed to him for more than 20 years now. And he said, there are no French Jews or American Jews or English Jews. There are Jews who live in France, Jews who live in America, Jews who live in whatever, in Germany. What he really said is that the Jewishness is a primary category. And for Blumenthal, his Jewishness is a primary category. This is why he's a member of JVP. And this is why he writes letters against me as a Jew. He is a primary Jew. He's a third category. And I actually expose his agenda. And I recommend every person who is interested in Blumenthal to look at a video that Blumenthal made about David Irving's visit in New York. It is very interesting because in this video, Blumenthal is actually operating as a Nazi hunter. He's not interested in what David Irving has to say. He's not interested in the story. What he wants to show there, a vile anti-Semite neo-Nazi, which is, in my opinion, complete nonsense. We are dealing with a revisionist historian, and I believe
David Irving's not a neo-Nazi.
No, for sure not. I hope that I made it clear, you know. But in the measures in which Max Blumenthal is operating, which is totally similar to Elie Wiesel and Bora Lipstadt and the hardcore Zionists. And the biggest question here, how did it happen that a Nazi hunter, a banal Nazi hunter, you know, at least Deborah Lipstadt is trying to understand the discourse or whatever, she wrote a book about it. How is it possible that extremely banal mind, such as Max Blumenthal, who doesn't even try to elaborate on the questions to do that are raised by Irving, and I believe that his ideas or thought should be encountered. How is it possible that this guy is becoming a progressive voice? No, it's a vile ultra Zionist voice, and I'm exposing it. And it's a war of idea. I try to deal with it in ideological terms. I would debate Blumenthal or Dershowitz or Foxman anywhere, but they're afraid to debate me because they don't stand the chance. And they don't stand the chance not because I can speak English. I obviously cannot speak English. They don't stand the chance because they know that I understand their agenda inside out. I'm the world expert on these topics. And on the Jewish left, deceitful agenda.
And that's the side that doesn't have the target on them too much. This usually the ultra right wing, very honest racist that I think people understand very well. But on the left side, the progressive side, who are also collectivists, and I like your term Azza, and it's perfect. The Azzas get away with it because they can say lots of nice things about what solutions they would like, but at the same time prevent dialogue about the roots of how these things came to be. So you're not allowed to look at you know, there are racist Jews, there are racist groups, there are race, you know, any religious group or any kind of in-group that does things for itself and for its tribe and tries to get its agenda implemented. But you're not allowed to admit that. You have to blame it all on other things. And because of that, they can't get at the root at it. And willingly or not, are protecting it.
Yeah, I agree with you. And the thing is that there is no way to save the world and to save us wherever we are, unless we revert to truth seeking.
I think the left is just very hypersensitive to any kind of labels, because that's how they are themselves. They've labeled everybody and put everybody in different groups, categorized by ethnicities and sometimes geography and so on. And they're really pretty silly. But then they project that onto others. The moment you say, well, you have this vicious sin group that's excluding others, then they'll flip out. But that's exactly what they're protecting with their collectivist ideology of putting everybody into asas. And yeah. I think they're blind to that.
I agree. And again, a lot of the people who support me, and it's not a secret that, you know, I enjoy a lot of support, are people who come from the left. And they obviously see that there's something wrong. You know, we were identifying with the Palestine cause. You know, we are dealing now with 48, now it's like 65 years of Israeli abuse. We are talking about 110 years of racially driven Zionism. And in most of the time, the left was complicit in it. And now, when it kind of for 4 or 5 decades that the left is against it, it still didn't manage to do anything. There is something that I don't know myself how to explore it. I didn't find a way, maybe I shouldn't talk about it yet, because I myself devastated by this thought. Yesterday I saw, I put it on my website actually, an interview with a Jewish Israeli Hasbara icon. I can look on my website and see who he was, but it doesn't matter. This guy is basically a propaganda master, a PR guy for Israel. He trains Israeli Hasbara students all over America and so on and so on. And he basically spoke about Israel as a product. He said, my product is Israel. My job is to give it a good name. And this product stands for democracy. I don't endorse or accept anything he says. I'm quoting now, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
He said, we are standing for Israel. My product is standing for democracy, tolerance, gay rights. You know, we were victims of 2,000 years of... persecution, and now we have our own Jewish state. What a beautiful thing. Beautiful, 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 beautiful. It would be very easy for me deconstruct what he was saying. But he spoke about Israel as a product, and he presented a case. And I thought to myself, what is the Palestinian product? being a victim, yes, they are victims. They are victims for six decades. But being a victim is not a good product. Try to sell toothpaste as a victim. No. What they sell about Israel, the Israeli product, is a victorious product. This is how they sell it. What is it that we try to sell about Palestine? And the truth of the matter, that when the Palestinians were fighting, they were a product. They were a product. When they were fighting for their rights, they were a product. I don't know if they can fight anymore. It's not easy. They are facing a devious enemy. But why they were a product? Because they say, you see, what happened to us by this Jewish nationalism is not different from what happened to you in America or in Europe. The reason I now actually go back to Max Blumenthal, I'm coming very close to say there is Jewish identity politics. Zionism or Israel is just one symptom of Jewish identity politics. That credit crunch is another symptom. Milton Friedman, who speaks about Jews and capitalism, is another symptom. There are a lot of symptoms. And this is a product that we have to deal with.
And within certain occupations, and I mean like in jobs, you have a sense of sort of ethnic nepotism. And that's a horrible thing too. And that's for exactly. Jews or whoever, but they'll have a sense of ethnic nepotism and collectivism. And they don't see that as bad or wrong. It should be based on merit, of course, fine, but it's not. You know.
But you're entitled to see it as bad.
Because yes,
because if you work in a bank and you're actually very, very good in what you're doing, but you're not promoted because somebody dropped from outside because of tribal affiliation, this is like annoying. But anyway, what I really did, I identify something that could easily mature into a product. And I am not opponent of the Jews. No, I have Jews in my band. I love them. I have a Jewish wife. But I'm definitely a vile opponent of Jewish politics because I find it exclusive and racist. And this applies to Israel, but it also applies to Jewish left that stops us from criticizing Israel for what it is. I identify an enemy in every form of Jewish secular politics. I find Jewish religious far less problematic. And the truth of the matter is that rabbinical Judaism has never been involved or complicit in a mass murder, in a genocide. But when it comes to Jewish left, it is very embarrassing. The Nakba was performed by Jewish Zionist socialists. Devastating. When it comes to Holodomor, again against Yuri Slezkin, the Holodomor, the gulags, the crimes of Stalin, the colossal crimes of Stalin were largely committed by Jewish Bolsheviks. I want to look into that. This is my role.
They want the collective victimhood, but they don't want the collective when it's the other way when they've done something bad, of course.
Yeah.
And really, you have to look at it as it's usually governments, not ethnicities or anything like that. It's usually governments doing these things. But there are racist groups. There are racist Jews. But you are not allowed to point that out. Or you're Hitler,
whatever. Not allowed every time, and this is a rule that I'm told, it's not just about Jews. You know, many years ago, we had a gig here in Hartlepool. It's here on the northeast of England. And before we go to Hartlepool, you know, somebody called me, a friend, and told me, listen, you know, when you get to Hartlepool, make sure that you don't mention the monkey. And so, what is the monkey? So, no, don't mention it. Obviously, I found out what is the story about the monkey. There was a French ship, a battleship that sunk after shelling Hartlepool in one of those wars. And the only survivor from the ship was a monkey. And they took the monkey for a trial. And they hung it, or you know, put it against the wall, you know. So it's something that the Hartlepoolians are very embarrassed about. And I was told, you never talk about the monkey in Hartlepool. And the first thing that I had to do in the gig was to talk about the monkey. You know, when you tell me not to talk about something, you open a discourse. You know, every
like
time
that, I've been told.
When Ali Abu Nima wrote to me, listen, just say Zionism instead of Jewish, and then everything will be fine. We have a lot of common ground. He basically asked me to lie. I asked myself, why does a Palestinian ask me to lie for the Jews? Wow. And there are a few members that you can have few answers.
Well, the reasoning is that everyone doesn't understand. They don't all have the same definition of the terms that you do. So when they hear the word Zionist or Jewish, when most people hear the word Jewish, they just think anybody of those three categories you named, someone who believes in Judaism, somebody whose parents were Jewish and read the innocent categories, and the third one, the bad one. They just think all of them. So you're collectively saying any Jew. That's what they think of when they hear the word Jewish,
so,
which is why they want you to say Zionist.
I would expect a person who is a researcher, apparently, in Chicago University, and also an editor of a major Palestinian outlet, to know inside out what is the difference between Zionism and Jewishness and so on and so on and so on. And he could have a chance to say, I mean that and that, and you know, but he didn't. And even now, when he had to defend himself, he failed to do it. Which means that he actually asked me to lie. And they all asked me to lie. I have letters here. This, the way it is operating, I have a letter from another guy, you know, he's a pathetic activist here, Tony Greenstein. He wrote to me a letter a few years ago, and he told me, just denounce Israel Shamir, and we will be with you, we will support you. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
I have another letter from that Tony Greenstein to another activist, where he write to her, listen, you give me Gilad Atzmon, dirty stuff on Gilad Atzmon, and I'll give you some dirty stuff on Ken O'Keefe. Huh. They're trading, not in truth, in smear. I enjoy exposing it. I enjoy. Because it is not a coincidence that the situation in Palestine is worse than ever. If the BDS movement has given on 1948 in a clandestine manner, just because it is supported by George Soros, who supports the Zionist J Street, Palestine is not represented very well. And again, it's not down to me to save Palestine. My job is very simple. My job is to expose the fundamentals to do with Jewish power. Now, the problem is that I'm starting a rehearsal in 10 minutes.
I was getting ready to cut you off anyway because we went over an hour a little bit.
I have to get ready, you know, if you understand. I hope that you forgive me. But if you need more, we can. I really enjoy talking to you.
That's a fun conversation. I like it.